Well, good evening, Mets fans. This is Rich Farrago, known on Twitter as MetFanRich and CT MetsFan, and you are listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike on Sunday, August 1st, where we find our New York Mets in first place, and there is so much to talk about going on with the ball club. So I think when we have a situation like that, and we're going to try to deliver you a very tight show on time tonight, so let's jump right in. No time to waste here. So let me bring on my co-conspirators in podcasting first. Let's start in the great borough of Brooklyn and bring in Mr. Mike Lacolin. Mike, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. Thank you, Rich. And hello, Metsville.
Very good. And now the man we like to call the CEO, Grand Poobah of podcasting operations, the brains behind the operation, Mr. Sam Maxwell. So, Sam, how are you? And as I always say, where are you tonight?
I am in the great state of New Jersey, where our guest writes for. And, you know, I'm basically teetering on – I'm on the fence right now. Like, I'm very optimistic always, and the team continues to shine through every time that we think that they're going to collapse and fall apart. I don't like all the comparisons and hearing everything that this is the best they've ever done going into August since 2007, 2008. I don't want to hear those numbers, but it is what it is, you know. It's the facts, and hopefully they can sustain this, and it's nothing else like those years.
I think that might be right, and we have our special guest to help us break down the trade deadline, where the team is now, where they need to go. This is a voice you've heard on this podcast before, but more importantly, a voice you hear every night in both the pre- and post-game shows from The Record and part of the USA Network. We have Mr. Justin Toscano. So, Justin, thank you for joining us tonight, and how are you doing?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I'm doing pretty well after this Kumar Rocker stuff. Just never really a dull day on the beat, huh?
Yeah, probably not. So let's start there. There's so much to talk about, and I can't really even prioritize. So let's start with Kumar Rocker. So, Justin, to you, the 5 o'clock deadline came and went. The Mets did not sign him. Now,
right.
You know, people are making stories up in their head. If you read Twitter, they're saying the Mets are cheap. It's the Wilpons all over again. It's the dollars. You know, I don't know what it is. I mean, obviously there were some issues with his arm. So what can you tell us about the Kumar Rocker situation?
Yeah, it actually just put out a story on this. I called you guys a couple minutes late, but I had heard that obviously Scott Boras released his statement about just saying earlier, right after the deadline passed, that Kumar Rocker was healthy and, you know, that there weren't any concerns on these MRIs this year, but compared to like his 2018 MRIs. And so what I had heard is that the Mets actually, so they'd reportedly agreed to the $6 million signing bonus, but that was pending a clean physical, of course. So I had heard that the physical, in fact, was not clean, something that, I think has been out there. But the Mets really didn't offer anything after that physical. So, and I made sure to check that, you know, they didn't try to get a discount or didn't. And I was told that they wouldn't have even done it for a dollar, just because they would just rather have the compensation pick for next year, which is going to be the number 11 overall pick. So the pick plus one. And so that to me, I know fans are upset, but look, like the teams try to determine with these physical exams, if this guy, you know, whoever they picked is going to be, if the results they see are going to lead this guy to be a productive major leaguer for years to come. And that's where they're really going. So, I mean, they don't, you know, it's not necessarily that they think that his arm's going to fall off tomorrow. It just means that they saw things that were concerning that they had no prior knowledge of. I think that's a big thing too, is that I had heard that a couple teams in front of them had, you know, reached out to them, you know, very shocked about, you know, when the stuff about Rocker's elbow started to surface in reports. I think it was the New York Post originally reported it. But, I think it was more of the situation of the Mets at the end of the day felt that the 2022 pick would be a lot more valuable. They don't think this Rocker situation is going to set them back. I mean, obviously, you know, they do view it as like a gut punch. I mean, it is a tough situation. They really wanted him. I mean, they were elated and felt, well, it was a blessing when he landed in their laps on draft night. But I think the big thing is just that they, you know, they would rather have somebody that they feel completely comfortable with. And at the end of the day, like, there are a lot of guys, not only their team doctors, but they, you know, they receive multiple opinions on his physical results. And so I think at the end of the day, Mets officials really weren't going to go against what they were told by medical professionals. I mean, that would be a little bit robust.
Certainly sounds it. And that's very fascinating information. So, you know, there's a lot to unpack here. The easy answer, and a lot of fans took the path of money, which I never thought it was, not with Steve Cohen being the person with the bankroll. I never thought it was that. I thought it had to be something to do with the physical aspect of it. And it sounds like that that clearly was it. You know, and if you bring your mind back about 6 weeks when they drafted him, in the middle of June, I think it was, there was a reason this guy was 10th. I mean, it was picked 10th. And he's supposed to be so great and all that, which I'm sure he is. But there's a reason why other teams passed on him. And there had to be speculation of this physical situation. The Scott Boras thing, I take with a grain of salt. You know, as he represents him, so right. Of course he's trying to get the best deal for his client. But I think, you know, I trust the Mets here. I think the Mets probably did their due diligence, and they've decided, like you said, the pick next year is of more value to the organization than Kumar Rocker is, given his current health. And we don't know what that is. I mean, will this guy need Tommy John in a year? Who knows? But whatever his current state is, the Mets, after doing their due diligence, made that decision. And I trust that they did it right. I really do. And so, Sam, let me turn to you. You know, let's keep going with the Kumar Rocker. I mean, what is your reaction to it as a fan?
For one thing, it was just fascinating hearing the different layers of the way this is gone. And, you know, Justin, I'll go to you with this, that I think it's hard for the fan base to shake sure. off the idea that the Mets may be actually competent at something now. You know, obviously it's been an uneven season, but, you know, you can tell that the Wilpons are still basically running the mind of the fan in many ways. Do you see that as well? And would you also agree that this may, as much of a gut punch as it is, you can tell that this front office and new ownership has a tighter ship going. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah. I was actually told by somebody that who was aware of those narratives on Twitter that, like, no, the previous Mets ownership probably would have caved to the public pressure on Twitter and signed the guy, you know, with all that they knew. And so I think it is completely different. You know, it is a gut punch. I think it's a different era, to answer your question. Like, I get it. You know, it's a gut punch. Like, fans wanted this guy. You've heard about this guy for 3 years because he's pitched on the biggest stage for one of college baseball's best programs, you know, a perennial contender. Like, he falls to 10. Of course you want him. And like I said, you know, his physical doesn't mean that his arm's going to fall off tomorrow. I was told, like, could he pitch tomorrow? Sure. Like, of course. We saw the workload he had this season. But a team in its determination is supposed to make the right call for the long-term future of the organization. And I think, yeah, this front office is a lot different and more competent. They're getting more voices on these things. And look, like, you know, what does it do for them if they have Kumar Rocker in their system when everybody and their brother in the baseball world knows that there was some hitch in his physical, yet they still signed him? You know, are they going to be able to trade him in the future? Are they going to be, you know, like, you're not really setting yourself up with a lot of possibilities in terms of kind of how people, you know, in terms of it, the long run in the system. So, yeah, I do think that there's, like you said, I mean, like you said it perfectly. I think the Wilpons are still running the minds of a lot of Mets fans. And listen, I get that. Like, I totally get it. Everybody's hyped for the draft. That's the first round pick. But if you circle through the layers of this thing, like the different narratives, like, there was public pressure. Like, if it were the Wilpons, they, you know, the previous regime probably caves to the public pressure and to Scott Boras. And, you know, like, if you read Scott Boras' statement, I just didn't take a lot out of that just because he said he was healthy. Like, yeah, you know, he could be. He didn't really say anything. You know, he didn't really I mean, he didn't really hint at anything, and it was just kind of like a – he didn't really say much. But I do think, you know, if then you go to money. You guys just mentioned it. Like, they were prepared to pay the full $6 million. I mean, it wasn't money, especially not under this ownership, especially because they built the draft around him. Like, of course they would want to sign him. You know, that would give them more incentive to sign him. They built the draft around him. And, I mean, like, they – you know, after he was picked, six of their next nine picks in rounds 2 through 10 signed under slot. So, like, of course they were, you know, prepared to sign him, prepared to shell out that money. I just think that – I mean, it's tough for fans to swallow. I get it. But it's sometimes you have to make these tough decisions. And like I said, they're not happy about it. Like, they're far from enthused. And they – you know, I heard, you know, of course they feel bad for Rocker. They said in the statement that they wish him nothing but the best. And, you know, I was told by somebody that, you know, maybe he goes on somewhere and has a great pro career. Like, they certainly hope so, just because for the kid's sake. Like, it sucks for him. They know that, you know, without this, he's not making any money. But the interesting caveat that he was selected for that top, you know, draft pick pitcher, like pre-draft MRI program that the league offers. And if you don't participate, and you're selected and don't participate, then the team that selects you doesn't even have to offer you anything. Like, they can forego that. So, I mean, the Mets didn't view it as concerning that he didn't participate, but it's just that, you know, I mean, there were some concerns, obviously, but I just think, you know, if this were the Wilpon, I mean, they probably caved to the public. I think, if anything, like, fans should be happy that the team's doing its due diligence. Like, sure, you know, they probably screwed up the draft strategy. And I heard that from somebody that, you know, the Mets kind of feel like they could have done it a bit differently to protect against something like this, just in case it happened. But I think, one, they like the players they picked. And two, you know, I think as a fan, like, wouldn't you want them doing their due diligence and on all this stuff and, you know, getting the information from their doctors and outside opinions instead of just, you know, offering this guy to do it? I mean, I feel like the, you know, next year they can get a player like, you know, they like, and somebody, you know, they're not concerned. They're more comfortable with health-wise. So I just think that, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of, like, I get why the Wilpons are still running some minds a little bit, but I just think, I don't think this is nearly as big of a deal in terms of, like, the Mets being shady that people are making it out to be. It seems kind of like a weird situation.
That's the way it seems to me, too. And, Mike, please run with this. Any questions for Justin or your own comments on the Rocker situation?
Well, very quickly, you know, it's just unfortunate. Insofar as the number one draft picks, you want to get them correct, don't you? But, you know, the MLB draft is a gamble to begin with. Out of all of them, you know, the NFL draft, NBA, NHL, I think baseball's draft is the most uncertain. So I'll classify this as being it is what it is. Unfortunate, though.
It is, for all parties. I think that's really well said, Mike. And so, Justin, while we have you, I think the thing, you know, there's so much more to talk about. There's DeGrom, there's Diorme and Nimmo and the loss of losing 2 out of 3 to the Reds, which I consider to be a blown opportunity because the Phillies and Braves both lost 2 out of 3 in their weekend series. But let's go to probably the biggest fish in the pond here, and that would be the trading deadline. So,
yeah.
The Mets end up with Javier Baez, right, and of course, and Trevor Williams, who will be up with the team, I'm sure, very soon. So let me – here are my questions. I'd like you to evaluate that. I think they did okay, personally. You brought in a two-time All-Star who – and as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to spend prospect capital like Pete Crow Armstrong – why not bring in a guy that at least you have a chance of retaining? And Baez has made his point about playing with Lindor and all that. Who knows what will happen, but at least there's something to this. So I'd like you to comment on if you think the Mets did okay, did they underwhelm? I'd like you to comment on that. And then if you have any information you could share about things that they may have been working on that didn't come forth, like we heard about Berrios, but what else can you share? So, Justin, if you can go with those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, you know, it feels weird. I think the public opinion and Twitter opinion are so far, you know, there's such a far gap between that. So I know a lot of people on Twitter were upset. I would give it probably a B. Like, do I think they could have gotten another starter or, like, moved quicker on somebody like Tyler Anderson? Sure. Like, do I think they could have gotten, like, another high leverage reliever? even one, you know, that wasn't like a Craig Kimbrel, like, yeah, sure. I mean, I definitely think so. But look, I mean, they brought in a two-time All-Star, a Gold Glover. I think he's won a Silver Slugger, too. A guy that, I mean, like, he's tied with Pete Alonso for most home runs on the team now. Like, he came in with 22 bombs, like, when, you know, when they traded for him. And so I think he also, you know, that bat also solves, not solves, but goes towards solving some of the issues against left-handed pitching. So I think they did great there. But I mean, the things that I, you know, that seemed like the Mets were working on and really like the passions of the world probably had it more thorough than I did, to be completely honest. So I'll go, but just like the asking prices, I heard we're getting more reasonable, you know, as a Thursday night, but we've seen so many reports about what Minnesota wanted for, you know, Berríos. And I just think, you know, with that, and then even like Max Scherzer wasn't going to play for them. Like, it just wasn't happening just because of his 10-5 and the no trade clause, and he can veto anywhere. I mean, Zach Scott made that clear without saying Max Scherzer's name, that he wasn't going to be playing there, and that just wasn't happening. And then I think the Berríos ask, and I'll even go back to weeks ago, I think the guy who covers the, you know, Dan Hayes from The Athletic, who covers the Twins, reported like weeks ago that they were asking interested teams for two top 100 prospects and then a pre-arbitration a major league player. And I just think that's a pretty ridiculous ask. So I know that, you know, a lot of the fans think there should have been a better name than that brought in than was. But I think they did okay, just because I don't really – they're not in the position with that. I think their system, as I see it, is very top-heavy. Like, I like the top five guys. I liked Pete Carl Armstrong. Past that, there's not a ton of depth as in the way I see it, and at least not yet. And so I don't think you can really afford to mortgage that future for one season. So I think they did good in getting Baez because, yeah, they did show their guys that, you know, they're going to back them up and they're getting a big bat for, you know, the stretch run. Somebody who's good on defense, too. Like, they got a big name. But I just don't see it possible that they could have gotten any of those frontline names or, you know, even anyone better just because, you know, even the Rockies held on to John Gris. So I just think a lot of their options, guys that they might have been talking to, you know, they didn't really have access to some of those players or maybe some of them they'd been talking about. And so I think they did okay, completely, like, personally. And what I just, like, followed from the passings, you know, the world and just, like, you know, what they were working on, it just doesn't really seem like it was feasible. And that's – and I think it goes to show, like, look at the teams who get the deals done, like the Dodgers or one of them. It's like you need prospect capital, and it's just like this team doesn't have it, like in the sense that they don't have the 6 to 10 range that they would love to trade because they probably can't afford to, like some other, you know, system, you know, clubs, organizations can. And obviously they were going to want to stay away from their 1-5 guys, even if, you know, teams wanted Ronnie Mauricio, which is a name you heard a lot in rumors. But I just think – I think they did fine. Like, you don't want to overpay for rentals or even guys with only a year plus of control if you don't know, you know, who you're resigning. Like, it's just – I think they did better than what they're getting made out to be, you know, kind of in public.
That's exactly where I am with their performance at the trade deadline. Mike, your thoughts on the Mets at the trade deadline? Questions for Justin.
K is a very appropriate word. Look, necessity is the mother of all invention. We know that. So this trade was necessary. And, you know, it fits a particular need. And if you look at Baez, Lindor, Alfonso, Conforto, Smith, et cetera, you know, you can call them a viable player contender. But at the same time, you know, I'll ask the rhetorical question to Met fans. Do you want to win a World Series now, or do you want to win 3 down the line? And I'm leaning towards the latter. I think they have more work to do. As Justin says, you know, the Dodgers, they're well-stocked in the system, and they're well-stocked at the major league level. And that's a level that the Mets are still trying to achieve insofar as talent, you know. So I still think we have more work to do. So for the meantime, I think this is fine.
Sam, you're up.
Oof. Well, I think when you have a chance, you know, anything can happen, all of those cliches. And I hear where you're coming from, Mike. I've heard one thing, just to put out the opinion, I'm also fine with what they did. And when you really think about it, going back to the, you know, this is kind of a narrative for me, the difference between the contrast of the Wilpons versus Steve Cohen. And also, you have to remember that Sandy Alderson is handling a lot of stuff and is the brain trust at the top of the front office right now. Sandy Alderson, one of the things I liked when he was brought in 2011 was the fact that he doesn't give a hoot about headline grabbing. And when you look at, like, the Yankees were not able to get the pitching that they kind of needed. They may have gotten some leadership that they were sorely lacking, and so I can't say that the trades that they made for Joey Gallo and Anthony Rizzo were just exactly only headline grabbing. But when you look at, like, where the Yankees were and what everybody thought they needed and the trades that they made, they got a lot of splash. But it's kind of what you would see happen with the Mets. Now, I think, you know, it goes back to that karma thing and how, you know, Met fans would think that if they were traded for an Anthony Rizzo, he wouldn't be performing the way he's performing for the Yankees right now. But, like that, that's what I'm looking at, that they didn't make a trade just for the sake of making it. They made a very identifiable trade, not to mention the different pitchers that you could say, you know, Rich Hill, Trevor Williams, their bodies, but they also have some track records, and they have some track records with some winning teams. So I'm completely fine with what they did. I do think it's going to be very difficult to beat the teams that they're most likely going to have to face down the line if they win this division. But at the same time, you know, we didn't think Patrick Mazika was going to be walking off in the first, like, 2 weeks. So this is a crazy year, and we have yet to see everything.
in Metsville, with exactly 2 months or 2 months and 2 days left in the season, I think it's fair to say there will be things we aren't contemplating now that will happen. So, Justin, again, so much going on right now. I think the next place we have to go is DeGrom because, okay, I'll give you a fan's perspective, my own, and then, you know, please comment, then I'll bring it over to Sam and Mike. I wanted with all my heart to believe that everything that was happening was, you know, like that movie, A Series of Unfortunate Events, right? Oh, okay, it was a shoulder. Oh,
yeah.
It was just a series of unfortunate events, nothing to see here, move on, right? And I wanted with all my heart to believe that, but my head was telling me there's something wrong here. And I don't think I'm unique. I think everybody's head, most Mets fans' heads were telling them that. And now those fears have manifested because he had the forearm issue, very slow, you know, throwing very lightly, now shut down for 2 weeks. So here's where I'm going with it. What are you hearing? Is it really he shut down for 2 weeks and we might see him in September? Or gulp, could this be the beginning of another Tommy John? Because it always starts that way. I remember with Matt Harvey, it was a forearm issue. A lot of these guys complain of pain in their forearm at first. And I've also heard that the life expectancy of a Tommy John surgery is, I heard, like 7 to 9 seasons, and that's about how long ago DeGrom that is, a little bit farther than that. And he's throwing at this ridiculous velocity. So what can you tell us? What can you tell Met fans about DeGrom?
Yeah, basically what I've heard is, you know, what's been – I mean, I haven't heard anything different than what we had heard – what I had heard a couple days ago, which was just, you know, he's going to be shut down for 2 weeks. They don't know anything more, or at least, like – let me just add the caveat because I don't want to sound dumb here that they say they don't know anything more. Like, this started as – I mean, really for me, like, the alarm bells went off when he pitched in that doubleheader and then didn't pitch – again, you know, right after the break, and then finally we learn he had, you know, some forearm tightness. Fine, all good, right? But Luis Rojas said that he didn't know about that forearm tightness. Well, DeGrom then said a day later that he told Jeremy Hefner over the break about that. So then we're led to believe that Jeremy Hefner didn't tell Luis Rojas. So that's kind of just the start of it all. You know, you dismiss that. And then on Friday, Luis Rojas said that DeGrom didn't throw, but he was feeling good. he was fine. You know, he was just took a day off from throwing, right? Oh, 3 hours later, we learned that, you know, oh, he has elbow inflammation, and the Mets knew that. They had formed that plan to shut down DeGrom about an hour and a half before Luis Rojas spoke to the media. So you kind of really, like, to be completely honest, you kind of really don't know what to believe. And I've tried very carefully, like, to be very, very thorough if I do, you know, report something on injuries that wasn't said publicly, just because of that. You know, I've heard what's been out there, but I think, like you said, I mean, I guess you just never know, and maybe nobody knows, maybe not even the medical professionals do right now. They're hoping this is just elbow inflammation that they can get out in the 2 weeks that he's shut down from throwing so then he can ramp up and be back in September. But one, his Cy Young case, you know, is all but dead, you know, effectively. And two, yeah, even when he does come back, if and when he does come back in September, what can the Mets expect? Because remember, this is a guy who now has had six different ailments this season. So, I mean, it's, yeah, this is something that I believe in what Zach Scott said in the structure of the postseason when he was speaking after the trade deadline, and that, hey, you know, if you get in, the structure is such that if you get in, you know, you have a shot. And he even mentioned the NL West arms race and said that, you know, one of those teams realistically is going to be knocked out because they're basically going to cannibalize each other if they make the wild card game, if two of them make the wild card game. So he said, we're not even going to have to play one of those, you know, until X round as it stands right now. And so I believe in all that. But if you don't have DeGrom, I mean, it becomes a lot tougher. And, you know, it's tough to trust that he's going to be there, you know, in September and throughout the postseason. And to be completely honest with you, yeah, like I'm telling you that I've heard, you know, what's been out there in the shutdown for 2 weeks and nothing else. But I wouldn't be surprised if it turns into something else, just because that's how these things have been going. And this one in particular seemed weird from the start, just because of what I said. Like, you telling me that the Mets were going to, like, before we found out about the tightness, that they were going to keep their ace from pitching for, like, 10 days, you know, since his last, like, none of it ever added up. And so it's kind of weird to know where we stand right now.
Yeah. And I wonder if a lot of the gag order was around the trade deadline, you know, this way it seemed that was where my head went, was they were keeping this quiet. So if other teams knew DeGrom had a serious issue, the price goes up even higher. So,
right.
Sam, how about you? Questions for Justin, thoughts on DeGrom?
I think, I mean, you just said it too, in terms of the gag order and the trade deadline and why sometimes, even if the Wilpons are away, even if the Wilpons are no longer, you get some of these double talk cross, you know, crossing streams type thing going on. But again, like, you know, they're comfortable in however they need to communicate with the public. And I think sometimes us fans need to remember, number one, this isn't a legislative branch. This is not the type of there's only so much that they owe us as fans in terms of transparency and communication. This, you know, we're not talking about a government here. So it is unfortunate because, you know, we've been hoping. And I'll go, you know, since you're going to go soon, Justin, I'll direct this towards you. You know, this is not just the Cy Young. This is not just the Mets playoff chances. This also, you know, we're caught up in whether Jacob DeGrom can make the Hall of Fame. You know, there's so many different factors. And meanwhile, you have a pitching coach that had to get two Tommy John surgeries and is a pitching coach because he can't pitch at age 33. So there are a lot of different things to be very concerned about when it comes to Jacob DeGrom.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think, that is a good point. I do want to key in on something first that you mentioned. You know, like, as a reporter, people in my industry would probably shoot me for saying this, but I totally agree. Like, it sucks to not have the transparency, but hey, like, that's competitive advantage, competitive disadvantage. Like, I would never tell somebody that if I were in the same position as them, that I'd be telling the media and fans all these things, like, publicly. You know, there's an aspect to winning in this. And like I said, competitive advantages and disadvantages. But, yeah, I know what you mentioned is true. I mean, we're caught up in the midst of kind of a Hall of Fame case that you knew going into the season was a real possibility for Jacob deGrom if he could continue this. Now these injuries, I think, have a lot of fans worried. And, you know, I don't know if I would say that I'm worried about it because I don't know, you know, any of the medical, what the MRIs look like. I just know what we've been told publicly. So I don't know if I'd use the word worried, but you do wonder the longevity of Jacob deGrom after a season like this. You know, you do wonder if all the 100-mile-per-hour, you know, fastballs catch up to an arm. You do wonder if finally it's, you know, it's his age, even though he didn't have as much mileage on his arm as pitchers did earlier, you know, in his career. Yeah, you wonder about all of that. You know, it's about, you know, not only the trade deadline, the postseason, the Cy Young, but it's kind of about a guy's career, and you hope really that, like, you're not nothing that we've – you just hope nothing that we've seen this year – trying to put this in a good way – nothing that we've seen this year, you hope it's not just – it's not an indication of what's to come. You hope it's not the beginning of the end. And I think, like, after one injury, fine. After two, all right. After three, they've all been minor. But all those little minor injuries, I mean, you think, like, you know, it's just weird to me that they've been unrelated. You know, it kind of just makes you think when the Mets say that, you know, all five of them were unrelated and there was no correlation. It's like, you know, if I, you know, if your mother took you to the doctor for five separate injuries and the doctor told her to her face that none of them were related, you know, like, you, she'd probably, like, look at him like he were crazy. And so, like, I just think, you know, you just hope it's really – you really hope it's not the beginning of the end, and you really hope that Jacob deGrom is fine and comes back strong and this is another minor one, just because, you know, the player and the person are so special there just with him and how he's been able to electrify baseball and kind of defy all the odds really since college, since he was riding the bench at Stetson and was like a backup infielder. And so I just think, you know, it is so much bigger than that. But I do really – you know, I really, really hope and pray that this isn't anything indicative of his future.
Yeah, no, very, very well said. And this is the Metsian Podcast. You're listening to the Metsian Podcast. We have special guest record Meet Mets Beat writer, for the record, Justin Toscano. And Justin, I know time is running very short. We want to be respectful of that. Mike, I know you had a question for Justin. Certainly, if you have something on DeGrom, I know you had a different question you'd like to ask Justin while we have him.
Okay. I have a big smile on my face because I don't want to go here, but here I go. Just Michael Conforto, obviously this is his contract year and he's not performing well. He had those five games against Pittsburgh and Cincinnati in which he went 8-for-21, 4 home runs, 8 RBIs. Now, I've been complaining throughout the season that he's just not the type to put the team on his back and carry them. Instead, he's been that guy who picks things up and puts things down. Since July 20th, he's gone 4-for-39. That's a batting average of 102. Zero home runs, zero runs batted in. There's a million directions you can take this, Justin, but your overall observation and, you know, what does your crystal ball say?
Oh, yeah, I think so if I recall correctly, the last time I was on this podcast was April 29th, right? It was right before that Philly series started. I think that series started April 30th, if my mind serves me correct. But and we talked about Conforto, and you mentioned, you know, his early season struggles, and, you know, we talked about how he could get hot. You know, he's always been that streaky player. The concerning thing to me this year is that the hot streaks have only lasted a couple of days. Like that one of them in Cincinnati – you know, that was, he had that two homer game. It was a pretty quiet two homer game because they scored, you know, 15 runs overall. But I mean, he's just been bad this year. He's made some big plays. Defensively, he's been tremendous. Like, I don't think anybody, you know, I think a lot of people, because of how poorly he's hitting, forget about the defense, which is fine. He's made some big plays though, defensively. Crystal ball wise, I don't think I ever would have seen myself saying this months ago, but you know, the Mets might, they might have other avenues and options to explore in how to offer extensions in their offseason and who to target, because as it stands, I mean, Michael Conforto might be, you know, might eventually ask more than they're just willing to pay because of what they've seen this year. It's kind of – it's concerning that it's lasted this long. I mean, he's always – but you're right. I mean, he's always been the guy who's been streaky, but, you know, the concerns about not being able to put a team on his back, I think, are, you know, are definitely maybe legitimate. I mean, he certainly can't, you know, in the way that somebody like Pete Alonso can, you know, and has for, you know, for the couple-week span where he's been on a tear. But it's going to be interesting because before the season, it was funny. Like, we all talked about, oh, do they extend, you know, Conforto with Lindor? Like, when are they going to get into talks about that? Should they just extend Conforto now as well? Like, and man, like, the Mets, they look pretty smart for waiting on that one just because of how it's turned out. And I don't think Michael Conforto is a bad player by any stretch, but he's had a season. The way these things seem to work is that when a player has a season like this in a walk year, another team is much more ready to offer him that money than the team he played for in that walk year. Just because of what they, you know, they saw. I mean, it's tough to give somebody a ton of money, especially because he'll conceivably be one of the top outfielders on the market. And so I think it's, I mean, it's going to be weird. It's going to be tough, especially because his agent is Scott Boras. So it's going to be an interesting time seeing kind of that little tug and pull from both sides, because, like, do I think the Mets would like to keep him? Yeah, of course. Like, I think they are very adamant about what he brings, you know, defensively as a leader, somebody who's well-respected in their clubhouse, their union rep, like all of that. I think the entire package of Michael Conforto, and, into, you know, especially being a spokesman for the organization, I mean, he's great. But I just think that what they've seen offensively, it's going to be interesting to see how they handle it in the offseason, because that will tell you, as we get closer there, if they think offensively was just a rough year, or if they think there is something there that they cannot get past or they cannot rework. And it's just a lot of this year it's been timing. And Luis Rojas has actually been pretty honest about it, just the timing and how rotational his swing has gotten, which kind of, like, I was talking to Michael about this, which when he's too rotational, you know, doesn't allow him to kind of sit back as well. And so he's chasing, you know, he's more apt to chase pitches and he's more apt to not be on time for fastballs. So, and it looked like for a couple days, there was Mets were saying that he made that adjustment and then kind of fell back into what he was doing. And so I think, you know, it's been, for a streaky guy, this has been probably the worst, you know, streak you could have imagined. And at the worst time, I just think it's really unfortunate. But Crystal Ball tells me it's going to be an interesting offseason, just because, do I think in my heart of hearts they would like to keep this guy? Yeah, but I think it's going to come down to, like, hey, maybe he gets that big money from some other team that has seen from afar the whole package, you know, and maybe the Mets aren't as willing to pay it because they saw up close kind of the offensive struggles. And, I mean, especially with Steve Cohen's capital and kind of how active they've been, you know, since he acquired the team, maybe they see a different, you know, alignment for their outfield, especially if you – I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but I'm sorry to ramble, but, I mean, especially if you – say, you know, hey, if they wanted to extend Javi Baez in, you know, a rare world and have him just play second, like, if he's okay with that, maybe they move McNeil to right field, something like, I mean, you could go a million different directions just because of the versatility they have on their current roster. Now, is Michael Conforto a very good player? Yeah, I still think so. I just don't, it's just going to be tough to, it's tough to envision him getting anywhere close to the money, you know, from the Mets that maybe he could have gotten, you know, in the 100 millions range that you thought he might get before the season. It's tough to envision that now. And it's just going to be a matter of whether he wants to take that cut to stay with the Mets if they don't offer high, or if he just goes for the most money.
Or perhaps a qualifying offer, right? Because he might, I think, for Conforto to hit the open market at this point, he'd have to, I think he'd be crazy to coming off his, he'd be selling himself low, right? His stock term.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. I completely forgot to talk about that just because I think, heck, I mean, it'd probably be north of, you know, 19 million somewhere in where it was. And I think that, you know, that's about the arbitration salary for a star for like a year, but you know, you hope maybe, I mean, I think he would take it, and obviously the Mets would probably offer it just because, you know, you want the pick if he doesn't take it.
Exactly. So, Justin, we want to be respectful of your time. I know you have to go. I have one last question for you. I think it might make you laugh a little bit, but it's serious. Let me ask you this question straight up. Are the Mets going to make the playoffs? Honestly, with everything you've seen, with where the Phillies and Braves are, with DeGrom, everything we've talked about, in your heart of hearts, are we having a podcast like this in early October about Mets playoff baseball?
Yeah, 100%. I honestly don't really see any other avenue, guys. I know every time I say so, I get killed on Twitter. Like, oh, have you seen the offense? Have you seen this? We're tossing out these guys in, you know, middle relief, and how can we win with it? It's not about winning, you know, like, would I say they're going to win the World Series? That's a little tougher to predict right now. But as somebody who has watched the NL East this season, I'm almost willing to go Buster Olney's route and bet the farm that they make the play. I just don't see it. Like, I've seen this team play Philly. Like, I've seen this team play Atlanta. Yes, they lost the last series to Atlanta, but that team is not good. Like, the bullpen is awful. Philly's bullpen, the same deal. Like, it's been terrible against the Mets. I think the Mets, they also seem to sometimes play up and down to competition. Like, they beat the Padres in their two series, you know, in the season series against them, but, you know, lost to the Pirates and, you know, had that mess. I think they will be fine, though. Like, I think this weekend in Philly is actually going to be very interesting, though, and I don't really want to discount the Marlins either. I mean, they've got good pitching, so that's going to be an interesting series. I mean, that's really a real trap series with, you know, four games here. But, I think they make the playoffs, guys. I don't really see, you know, anybody. Atlanta doesn't have the star power without Acuna, though they did look good at Citi Field, especially defensively, which was a surprise. I don't see Philly, you know, if the Mets were LOL Mets under the Wilpons, like, the Phillies are taking this to a whole new deal this year. I don't really see any way anybody else wins the division. Like, look, they've held the lead since May 9th, and you can look at their record over that span, and it's not even that good, and they haven't lost any ground. That's how bad the division is. Like, the division's just their best friend. So I don't see I probably took that way longer than you needed it, but I don't see any way. Like, I'm very confident they're going to make the playoffs. Like, something – even with what I've seen, like, something just disastrous would have to happen for them not to. I just think there's too much talent in that room. Like, even with Lindor hurt, even with DeGrom hurt, I think that team is still more talented than a lot. Plus, they've got a lot of games against the Marlins in the second half, a lot still left against the Nationals, who are now, like, I couldn't even tell you what that lineup's going to look like when they play the Nationals, what Washington lineup's going to look like. But this team has a lot of issues right now, but those issues don't really compare to what their competitors face in the division. And I just think I don't really see a way, unless some nuclear, you know, outbreak hits Citi Field or something. Like, I just don't see this team not making the playoffs. Does that mean they can be complacent? No. They've got to be careful because they're not leading the division by six games. But I think they're going to be fine when all is said and done, even if they just squeak in. Like, I don't really see any of these other teams having the steam to take them.
2006 Cardinals, they snuck in. I think they were 83-79, and they won the World Series. So there you have it. Now, Justin, going to let you go, Sam. Unless you have a last quick one for Justin, we can be respectful of his time and let him go.
For sure, Justin. The only thing I would ask you to do is give us and our audience your shameless plug.
Oh, yeah. So you can just follow me. It's Justin C. Toscano. My last name is Toscano. So that's on Twitter, northjersey.com. You can subscribe. It costs, $1 for 6 months or something. So do that. Keep reading. Keep following. That's my I suck at those shameless plugs. I hate them. They feel so awkward, but I appreciate you giving me the platform.
Thank you, Justin. Mike had to hang up, but he said to express the thanks to you. Thank you for joining us. We hope to have you on again, and hopefully – You're a prophet here, and we could be talking about Mets playoff baseball towards September.
It's they say it's better to be a prophet than a historian, right?
There you go. I love it. Thank you. Be safe. Are you physically in Miami at the moment?
Yeah.
Oh, enjoy Miami. Stay safe. Thanks for joining us, and we'll hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, fellas.
Thanks again, Justin.
Yep. Take care, Justin.
You got it. Anytime. You guys.
Take care. So, Sam, Yeah. It's me and you. The one topic we didn't get to with Justin, and I think we covered the highlights, but the one topic we didn't get to was this weekend against the Reds.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't land well with me. Of course, losing 2 out of 3 isn't going to land well with the Mets fan, of course. But I think the Reds can be beat. I know they have a terrible bullpen. And, you know, it's another example. You can look at it, it's a glass half full, half empty. You could say the Phillies and Braves lost 2 out of 3, so it's no harm, no foul. Okay, you can say that, and that's factually correct. But at the same time, you could also say, here's a chance to give yourself some distance. Start putting some daylight between you and the competition. The Mets didn't do it. So where are you on this weekend? Where are you, the pessimist or the optimist?
I'm an optimist, but still a missed opportunity. I mean, like, you're absolutely right. Like, I was looking at it, I was actually slightly surprised to see they hadn't lost any ground. And I think that is something the Mets have been very good at, or at least the Fates have been very good at handing them, the ability to not lose ground when they could very well be, like, 6 games buried right now, when you think about it, if we were anything like the NL West. So, but that's not what we're dealing with here. And you're only a circumstance of, you know, the opportunity presented, really. And this is the opportunity presented. They have a very good opportunity, I believe, at this point. And if I'm correct in my assessment of the standings when I read them and where all the games were, now that the Phillies obliterated the Pirates, they are 3.5 games back from the Mets. And the Braves are still fourth. This series coming up, Rich, I know that we're talking about the Red series, but I just really want to quickly say that I want a sweep. And I know that it's a big, easy letdown series. But think about the Mets going into the Marlins. And, of course, they were coming off the high of the National Series, which was a completely separate vibe trading deadline-wise than what ended up turning basically because of today's game, because the opportunity was presented to you last night when you had one of the best victories all season with your newly acquired shortstop. So, you know, today was really the biggest dud, especially with Stroman on the mound, pitching well at many different points throughout the game. But really, it does come down to the offense, and that's when everybody was screaming that you had to do something. Now, for one thing, it is crazy the splits that Javi Baez has, but he does insert himself as the second, like basically tier for tier from an RBI run-producing perspective. He is now your second go-to or your go-to, which Michael Conforto should be in the top three. We should be talking about Michael Conforto in the top three, but we're not, you know, this is what we were talking about earlier. But Javi Baez, whatever he, you know, the weird anomaly that makes him Dave Kingman, as Brian Kenny pointed out the other day, he's still a valuable commodity that will only cost you Pete Crow Armstrong. And you know, play this audio back if Pete Crow Armstrong goes on to win several triple crowns. He's an exciting player. He immediately got us back into that game last night. That was a very important home run, and that was a very important moment for him to break through to this fan base. So there are some positives to look at from this weekend, but today was really where the Mets, especially at home, especially with where they've almost dominated at home, they really needed to handle it.
Well, you can take that even further. You know, this was their longest home stand of the season, 11 games. They went 5-6. You know, this is a team that, oh, you know, they play very well at home and blah, 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 and then they did. I mean, I forget the exact number. I think they were 29-15, I believe, at Citi Field before this homestand, something in that order of magnitude. And what do they do? Lo and behold, they go 5-6. I mean, come on, Sam, right?
Now, Rich, do you think it has anything to do, and I'm not blaming the fans, but it's something that Howie has been talking about and being very shocked about, is that the New York, and I don't know what's going on with the Yankees, but at the Mets games, at least, people are not flocking back the way they are in some other ballparks around the country.
It's true. I was there Friday night, and it was nice. It was an electric atmosphere, but they only had 31,000. And okay, so, but I think they were so electric because the Baez trade was announced and they were back home. It was like, okay, here's our chance. So we're going to put some space here. You know, we're going to
the black jerseys, which ended up being kind of black, a punchline.
Right. Black jersey. Right. And then the next night, okay, well now we have Baez in the lineup. He's here. And it's Hall of Fame night for Ronnie Darling, who comes into your living room every night, along with Edgardo Alfonso, who is, you know, one of the most famous and of the 90s, and John Matlack, who's from my era, and 27,000 people. I mean, it's, come on, you know. And
we can get into this actually in terms of the Mets Hall of Fame. I'd like to go on to a tangent after the Red Series, but you're right. I don't understand it. Like, have the Yankees been able to get 40,000-50,000 at any point yet?
They have. They've packed the place a couple times.
So what do you think is going on, Rich?
I think there's a couple things. I think to a degree, people are uncomfortable going back, you know, for the COVID reasons. And I talk to people, and some people say, you know, I was sitting with the guy who runs my season ticket plan on Friday night, and he was saying that he won't go inside the club, you know, the Foxwoods Club, whatever they call it now, to get food or drink because you don't want to be in an enclosed environment. And I respect that. I totally get that. So I think the COVID thing is still in people's minds and they're thinking about being in crowded situations. I think that's part of it. It doesn't explain why Yankee fans have flocked back a bit more than Met fans have in the same city.
And especially with different positions of the teams at the same time.
Well, and I think
that's weird too. Yeah,
it is, and I think that's where I was going with it. I think although the Mets are in first place, I think the fans are still skeptical that this team, you know, is truly a first place team, and they're taking the wait and see approach. Whereas Yankee fans, maybe they're going back because they're a bit frustrated right now, but. They obviously can't be too frustrated lately. They played quite well last week. But Yankee fans might be in a different situation. They might be thinking, yeah, okay, things don't look great right now, but, you know, we brought in Gallo and Rizzo, and they just have that feeling, you know, that before they brought those guys in, that the front office is going to do the right thing and make this team competitive, and maybe Met fans are still skeptical. And that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Now, I was thinking the same thing, too, in terms of the skepticism, in that it's not just a wait-and-see approach with this first-place ball club. It's a wait-and-see approach with how this first-place ball club under this new regime handles themselves. Because, like, when you look at, like, 2015, when you even look at, like, 2019, and I think those two Washington series, you know, they go a different way. And 2019 went a different way where it looked like, you know, maybe this was basically recreating this was like almost like the, you know, the Giants facing the Patriots again. But unfortunately, the Mets couldn't break through that wall on that last day. But when you look at those games, with the trading deadline coming out of it not really the trading deadline in 2019, but that crazy streak the Mets had gone on, the Met fan bases, even if it were the Wilpons, like, they were able to sell that you gotta believe. Right now, and especially, like you said, coming out of COVID, I think that produces this, like, we're not, you know, we won't be fooled again mentality. And they're, you know, it basically, like we were saying, and even in just in terms of, like, the perception Cohen is having to shake the Wilpons, or not even the Wilpons were basically the perfect, you know, climax of awful from a legendary string of just ineptitude from an ownership and front office perspective of the Mets franchise. So now, like, we can't, like, if you're looking at the curve, if you were looking at it on a graph, if you were measuring it from an objectively, like, if there was some way to measure objectively, you know, ownerships and front offices, you know what that curve, the worst is just, especially like Jeff Wilpon trying to weasel his way into 5 years. That's definitely the way the third act goes on its way to the climax of the movie. You know what I mean? But now you have, right now, you basically had the denouement with Steve Cohen looking out onto the field, and there's going to be a trial period when it comes to the way that, that brains and consciousnesses have been shaped.
Yeah. Well, no, you're right. I think you said that the Will Ponders are running people's heads. So that's very well said. And I think it's, although Steve Cohen is very visible, I mean, he's got to be one of the most visible owners in sports, where he's on Twitter and he's interacting with people. You know, and you see the thing he tweeted, I think it was last night, something to the effect of the Mets have a gritty team, unlike a lot of the people on this site who use fake accounts. I mean, so he's interacting. He's not afraid to mix it up with the fans. He's not afraid to, you know, back in May when he announced that the game had been postponed against the Braves before anybody else did. You have the team owner saying the game is postponed on Twitter. I mean, but with all that said, I mean, he's a very smart guy. He's probably doing it because, A, he enjoys it, but B, he has to break that. You know, he's trying to probably establish people's minds. Look, I'm in charge now. Those guys are gone. I'm in charge now. And he probably feels he has to be as visible as possible to do that. But I wanted to get to your comment on Hall of Fame and ask you to run with that. Last night was Hall of Fame night. The Mets inducted Ron Darling, John Matlack, and Edgardo Alfonso. So where'd you want to go with that one?
I think there's a lot of places to go. The first thing that I will say is that I love that you basically took care of, from a historical perspective, for any children there, you took care of every era of Mets baseball except for, you know, because, you know, now we have to talk about the fact that, like, I think part of this conversation can be who's next. You know, if they were to have extended that past the 90s after Edgardo Alfonso, where would we go? Because that's going to have to eventually be represented. And now we're in 2021. But those are basically where I want to bookend the conversation, starting with Al Jackson. You know, some people were talking about the fact that it was just an achievement award, and I'm curious where you would go with this, Rich, because some people say that, like, and here's where I'll go. The reason why he wasn't actually put into the Hall of Fame as a player/coach or something like that might just be because they're still strictly keeping that to the way the players' numbers were. And I can respect that on that level, but some people also say that because of what Al Jackson meant to this organization and the so many firsts, regardless of what the career numbers look like, regardless of that, the first that he was in 1962 and in the record books now, on top of what he meant as an ambassador of the Mets for so many seasons, deserve to be placed into the Mets Hall of Fame. But like Greg Prince pointed out, you know, the achievement is represented in the Hall of Fame. So what do you say, Rich?
Well, you know, I think it's a way to acknowledge, I think you're right. I think it's a way to acknowledge Al Jackson for what he was. You know, he labored on a very bad team. He did, you know, he was pitching coach in the organization. I think Ron Darling points to him a lot as somebody who had an impact on his career as a pitching coach in AAA. So, yeah, I think it's fine. You know, I think you can acknowledge somebody by a Hall of Fame induction, a team Hall of Fame induction, who maybe that person's out-and-out numbers with that team were not great, but in context of what the guy meant and in the era he was, sure, I think it's fine. I think it's absolutely fine.
Yeah, so that's where I wanted to start with the conversation. Of course, in terms of the three, I guess, when, you know, just obviously I was really only there for Edgardo Alfonso, and still at the same time I was kind of a second, you know, I was a second division Mets fan, if you will, because I was a Yankees fan who still paid attention to all of Mets baseball at the time, but you know. John Matlack, first of all, was one of my favorite parts of Mets history as I've uncovered it. And so why don't we start there with your memories of John Matlack, Rich?
Well, you know, John Matlack, I remember when he came up, and just a few things that I remember about him, because I was still, you know, that was a kid at the time, but starting to have a concept of what was going on. I remember him getting it hit in the forehead by Marty Perez. I'll never forget that. Line drive, Marty Perez of the Braves. I believe it was 1972. Marty Perez hit a line drive. Matlack didn't get the glove up, hit him right in the forehead, and he had a fracture of his forehead. And I just remember that. I also remember him in the All-Star game, pitching in the All-Star game, getting the win, and I believe the 1973 season. And I could be wrong on that. And then just the way, and probably, you know, the stuff I remember beyond that would be, think about this. In the 1973 NLCS, remember, these were five-game series at the time. The Mets had lost game one in Cincinnati, and Matlack went out there and shut them out on two hits, complete game shutout. And this wasn't, I mean, this was the big red machine. And the Mets were obviously desperate for a win. You know, you didn't want to go down two games to none in a five-game series. And Matlack delivered the goods. You know, two-hit shutout. I think the Mets won the game 5-0. But for him to go out there and do that in that situation, it was just, you know, just an amazing performance. And then being just a solid left-hander, you know, I don't have his stats right in front of me. I can grab them. But just being a solid left-handed pitcher that – probably, you know, he didn't get as much notoriety as Kuzman and Seaver, but just being just a really solid, reliable arm. And again, he stands out to me mostly for that one game in the Reds in the NLCS.
That's beautiful. And, you know, it's still, I was thinking about it the other day, just in terms of that 1973 era. Just, you know, between everything, you know, with 1973 sandwiched in between and John Matlack coming up and being the rookie of the year, and just thinking about how it's still an era looked back at what ifs. And I was just thinking about the Chapman family in my documentary, you know, shameless plug, but when they were talking about the George Stone moment, you know, Kevin was pointing out to Sharon how, you know, people still are going, still after 40 years, are talking about that 1973 World Series, and how it's like, how could he have pitched Tom Seaver 3 days rest? Everybody knows. And how it's, you know, that passion still is still there. And that's what John Matlack basically represents to me, is that passion of Met fans and the pitching, how pitching rich it is, and that unfortunately sometimes, as we see, you know, like on a day like today, that doesn't matter how good the pitching can be, the offense is just going to falter. And that was, you know, everything. The reason why, when you look at John Matlack's splits, it's similar to what DeGrom has had to go through.
Yeah, he was a victim of run support. And I just pulled up his stats. This just blows my mind, especially given the backdrop of current day baseball. As a Met over seven seasons, he started 199 games and completed 65 of them, so basically a third. So one out of every three times this guy took the mound, he went the distance. Now, if a pitcher goes a distance twice a season, he's heralded as a hero, right? Matlack did it one out of every three starts. And it's just, you know, he was 82-81. as a Met over seven seasons, but with a 3.03 ERA. So what is that reek of? That reeks of poor run support. So, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. You know, those Mets teams of the mid-70s, they just could not hit. You know, 74, Matlack was 13-15. 75, he was 16-12. 76, when the Mets were good, 86 and 76 season, Matlack was 17-10. But you know, you look at some of these teams, you know, the 72 Mets were 15-10. And then he was 15-10, and then 14-16 and 73. But those teams just couldn't hit. And you wonder what this guy might have been, you know, if he had a good hitting team behind him. And when I look at his career stats over 13 seasons, 125 and 126, it just doesn't feel right, Sam. You know, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel right. John Matt was below 500. With a 3.18 career ERA. I mean, come on. You know, there's something wrong there. This guy pitched in bad luck.
It's just another one of those, you know, what could have been. And I think that, you know, I have a particular player that I'll tease right now that I think we can also talk about that could have been a Hall of Famer, a baseball Hall of Famer, that ended up not a baseball Hall of Famer, but and won't be, most likely. But I think he will be a Mets Hall of Famer, and I think it's appropriate that John Matlack, who could have been a baseball Hall of Famer had it been for different circumstances, but he deserves to be a Mets Hall of Famer. And with that, I think, you know, let's go on to Ron Darling. You know, we see this guy every night that we're watching baseball, and it is nice to, you know, just remind ourselves how he was just a part of a dominant squad in 1986.
He was. You know, he you probably have heard this discussed on the air, but the Mets in the mid-80s used to do something I thought was so cool. They the second home game of the season, they would call the Rodney Dangerfield game because it got no respect. And Gooden would always pitch, you know, if they opened the season home. Gooden would pitch the first game, and everybody would go to the game like crazy. You know, you have to – literally, people would sleep out for tickets. Not, no exaggeration, at Shea Stadium. Remember, this was the day before you could buy them online. So people would be sleeping in sleeping bags and on the cold Shea Stadium asphalt to buy tickets for opening day to see Gooden pitch. And then you'd get 20,000 when Darling pitched the next day, hence the name, you know, no respect game. And Ronnie jokes about that. But, you know, it doesn't diminish what he did. You know, as a Met, 99 and 70 is pretty darn good, you know. 29 games over 500 as a Met, 99 and 70, with a 3.50 on the dot ERA over nine seasons. So certainly performed well as a Met, again, in the shadow of Dwight Gooden, you know, in the mid-80s. But, you know, you could look at certain Ron Darling games. The one I think about is when the Mets were down 2-1 in the World Series. You know, Ojeda had gone into Fenway and won the game, so they made it 2-1 after the Mets lost first two at Shea. And Ron Darling had to pitch game four. What a huge game that is, because you don't want to go down 3-1. And, you know, in his hometown, he did quite well. You know, he Mets won that game, I believe it was 6-2. And, you know, Ron pitched a great game. Now, I'm not sure if you've read his book.
Gary, that was a Gary Carter home run, right?
Yeah, two home runs for Carter in that game, right.
Okay.
I finished his book on failure and success in the biggest game of his life. He talks about that game seven in 1986 and what that was all about. Now, he didn't, you know, he was out of the game, I believe, in the fourth inning. He did not have a good start there, but the Mets won the game, as we know. So he talks about, I highly recommend the book if anybody hasn't read it. But that was Ronnie. You know, he was solid. By the time the Mets traded him in the 1991 season, his better Mets days were behind him, although when he went to Oakland, he kind of revived his career. He was 15-10 in 1992. He had a very good year then, and then he had some sub-500 seasons and retired. So, but won 136 games in the major leagues, which is pretty darn good, 20 games over, 136 and 116. So, and especially – you know, 99 and 70, does that get you into a team's Hall of Fame? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But Ron Darling is a part of our lives. I mean, he's a part of the Mets organization, and he's been in the booth for 15 years now, since 2006.
Well, and let me ask you this. Don't you feel a little bit of like, you know, the Mets have representation anytime? Like, I'm not sure how much you watch MLB Network or you hear him on, like, a TBS playoff game. But, like, it's comforting to hear him being acknowledged as good at his job outside of the Mets organization too, you know, because sometimes you think to yourselves, even though obviously, you know, you have MLB TV and people can listen to Met games anywhere in the country, but like sometimes you think that GKR, Gary, Keith, and Ron are our hidden little big town secret.
Yeah, you do. And then when you see the booths are rated every year, I don't know who rates them, but the GKR booth is usually, it's almost always in the top five. It's not, I don't think it's ever been number one, which you wonder who's rating them, because how could there be a better booth than Gary, Keith, and Ron? How can there be better? Gary is the quintessential play-by-play guy. You know, he grew up a fan. That's great. You have Keith, who is a borderline Hall of Famer, in my opinion, should be in the Hall of Fame as a position player, and Ron, who, you know, like we've talked about, very solid major league career as a pitcher, so you're getting both perspectives. and, you know, they're entertaining, they're all of that. But, yeah, but Ron, I think, belongs there. I think it's a bit surprising it took this long, but good for him.
Yeah, absolutely good for him. And, I, you know, this is a complete separate podcast, but Keith Hernandez is one of the more egregious outside of Gil Hodges, not in the Hall of Fame, that could ever be argued. And I think that that could be an entire podcast. But we'll have a talk. I don't even need the tangent right now. I'm not even going to – like only the opening line. We're not making a paragraph here. I want to start the Edgardo Alfonso part, but not only did he deserve to be in the Mets Hall of Fame, but considering the way the Wilpons and Brody left him, it's nice to see, you know, we're starting to – however, I do believe he deserves a job other than ambassador in the organization again. But it's nice to – it's. I think this was the appropriate one. And you know, what was also really, really cool about having Edgardo Alfonso there was that, like, there were so many ex-Mets from the 90s that, you know, were still buddies that were all there to greet him, like Carlos Baerga and Ray Ordonez. How cool was that?
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice. And I think the Mets are doing a much better job of dialing in with their history, you know, and I think the way they do the Hall of Fame now, and you know, they've dedicated Jay Horowitz to doing that, having a relationship with the former players and bringing them in, it was very well done.
So Edgardo Alfonso, you know, I think this is, again, another one of those for Met fans, but this is what I love about being a Met fan, is that you don't, even though you could say, what if you thought that Edgardo Alfonso was going to, you know, have a 20-year career and be in the Baseball Hall of Fame as a New York Met, and that's obviously not the way it worked out, but that doesn't take away in any way, shape, or form for the fact, you know, for the career, the Mets career that Edgardo Alfonso gave this fan base.
To me, Edgardo Alfonso is an interesting case because he had a pocket of very good seasons. So, you know, if you look at his numbers, really, you know, 1997, fantastic year, you know, he hit 315, 10 home runs, 74 RBIs, but then that was just an appetizer. 1998, 17 home runs, 78 RBIs. Then you get into his prime. 99, just an incredible season. He had 304, 27 home runs, 108 RBIs. 2000, he hit 324 with 25 home runs, 94 RBIs. He fell off a little bit in 2001, had a nice comeback in 2002 by, at least average-wise, hitting 308. His power was down a little bit. So his
And just to throw that out there, 2002 he was with the Giants, correct?
No, 3. 2002 was the last year with the Mets.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay.
So Alfonso had a couple of solid seasons. You know, he had pretty much 98, 99, 2000, and 2002. So that's 4 really good years as a Met. And by all means, he should be in the Mets Hall of Fame. He had 4 outstanding years as a Met. Contrast that, you know, to some other players who had longer time, like Hernandez, you know, had more than 4 good seasons, and Piazza did as well. But when you look at Alfonso's body of work, for those 4 really good seasons, they were so darn good. He belongs in Mets lore. He belongs in the Hall of Fame, albeit his time on top, shall we say, was a bit compact.
Right. I mean, and you know, I guess so. How do you see, you know, he has a great walk year. You know, we're talking about Michael Conforto's walk year. 2002 was his walk year. So how did he do for the Giants after that?
Well, for the Giants, he clearly had – he was on the decline. The 2002 was his last really good season. So for the Giants in his first year there in 2003 at 259, 13 home runs, 81 RBI. Certainly nothing to be embarrassed about, but definitely not where he had been. And then in 2004, he hit 289, but his power was down 1177. And then in 2005, again, hit 277, but his power was way down again, and he only played 109 games. So Clearly, he peaked as a Met. He didn't have nearly the kind of career as a Giant that he had as a Met. And I had forgotten that he had a cup of coffee with the Angels and the Blue Jays in 2006. Not much.
So my question for you is, do you keep retrospect? Do you keep him? Is this just like another one of those, maybe he has a better career staying with the Mets. Maybe he stays with the Mets if they are better equipped to, everything we've talked about between the two ownerships. Do you think, like, in an alternate universe, Edgar Alfonso is a career Met? And regardless of what you think, the kind of career he would have had, do you think it was appropriate to let him go?
Well, at the time I did, because although he had a good walk year in 2002, so if you do the math on this, he was born in 1973. So in 2002, he would have been 27, 29, right? Yeah, he would have been 29. But to me, and I know he played older than that. He was never fleet of foot. He just looked to be that kind of a guy who wasn't going to he wasn't going to play into his late 30s. That's the best I can say it, Sam. It just, whether it was his body style, the way he carried himself, at 29, to me, he looked like he was 38. He wasn't nimble. And he was kind of like a fire hydrant kind of a guy. And to me, that's what I saw. So I remember thinking they did the right thing letting him go. I was not one of those people who thought it was egregious, and how could they do this? And if you look at it, they were right. I mean, he clearly, his 30-year-old season, although not bad by any stretch of the imagination, like I said, nothing to be embarrassed about, but from 30 through 33, his arrow pointed down. And he was pretty much done by his early 30s. He was pretty much done. His last season
right.
in San Francisco, 2005, he was 32, and he hit .277 with only two home runs and 43 RBIs. And he only played in 109 games. I don't know if he was injured. I'm going to assume he was at some point. He only played 109 games. But his career was over at a much younger age than you would have expected.
So you think it's conditioning?
I'm not sure if it was conditioning or what it was, but I don't know. He always looked a lot older than he was to me. He wasn't footed kind of a nimble athlete. He was a great hitter and a solid defender. Didn't have a lot of range, but there was just something about him that you just had a feeling he wasn't going to be Ricky Henderson playing until he was 42 and stealing bases. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. although I think that's a whole nother podcast to speculate how Ricky did it, because I've always thought that, what was it? Ferguson Jenkins said that there's probably a Hall of Famer who did steroids. And I wouldn't be surprised, considering it was the Oakland Athletics, that Ricky dabbled. But again, just throwing it out there, don't need to go down that road. Kind of ties into the Ron Darling stuff, since he was there around that time. But I guess I can't throw that out there without asking, what do you think?
About Ricky?
Yeah.
I honestly don't think so. I mean, Ricky to me was just one of those guys who fanatically kept himself in shape and just was able to perform into his early to, around 40, 40, 41, 42.
Do you remember the bottom of the 10th or the 10th inning of Ken Burns?
No, I do not.
Okay. There's a line in there where like some writer and God, I wish I knew, considering it's probably a modern writer. He says, this Hall of Famer says to me, or I ask the Hall of Famer, what is that? And this Hall of Famer says to me, it's a Jose Canseco milkshake.
Yeah.
And when you think of Ricky Henderson's, I see where you're coming from, and I'm sorry to cut you off there, but when you hear that story, you can kind of hear Ricky saying that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the classic Ricky is about the guy with the helmet that, I guess, I don't know. whether or not that's actually true, who knows, but where he said to John Olerud, like they had both played for the Mets and they both ended up, I think it was in Seattle. And he said, hey, you know, you wear the helmet in the field. We had a guy in New York who used to do that. And it was the same guy. That's a classic Ricky story, you know. Ricky was that's my kind of player. The guy had power, he had speed, you know. He was a little bit of a hot dog, but who isn't these days, right?
Right. Right, and obviously, you know, tie into the Edgar Alfonso era and him and Bobby Bonilla playing cards in Game 7 of the NLCS 1999. However, again, not a tangent we want to go down to. So here's how since we have about 10 minutes left, roughly, I wanted to bookend this Hall of Fame discussion since they didn't go past the 90s, and I, at this point, you know, you have to start having – obviously, David Wright is going to be in the Mets Hall of Fame. But let's talk some other names from the last 20 years. This is now a subject of discussion. I'll throw names out there right off the top of my head. I wasn't going to start here, but I'll start with Granderson, which people might argue about, but I think that you could argue – the both on and off the field, what he represented, and the fact that he was one of the best free agent signings of Mets history, I think that wouldn't be – I would not be – think that's egregious for what he meant to that 2015 squad in that era of Mets baseball. Carlos Beltran, of course, I think you might have to make an argument for R.A. Dickey, but I don't know if you can, if there's a big enough – past those just marvelous 3 years. Johan Santana, did I say Carlos Beltran? Because I, of course, Carlos Beltran should be. Anyway, go ahead. I think Daniel Murphy should also be thrown into that mix. Go ahead.
Well, you know, if you want to go back to like the 2005-ish, last 15 years or so, 15, 16 years, you know, Delgado had some very good years. Again, very short, though. You know, Delgado had a good 6, 7, and 8, and then that's it, you know, right? So three good seasons. Does that qualify as the team's Hall of Fame? Probably
I don't know. I don't know about that.
Yeah, probably not. Beltran had more.
Well, how many home runs? Like, how many home runs did he hit?
I'd have to pull that up. I would say over the 3 seasons, he probably hit about 85 as a Met. I'm going to say they rush the average difference. I'm going to throw 2009 out because 2009 he was hurt. So if you look at his numbers, so 2006, he had in 2006 38, then the next year he had 24. So by my math, that's 62. Add in another 38, that's 90. No, 62 plus 38 is 100. So yeah,
he had 104 home runs. 104 home runs, and that's what I thought the number was when I asked the question of how many home runs. I don't want to like brush my shoulder off, but I had the vision of 104, like I'd seen it before, and that's an interesting case. That is a sizable amount to get in 3.5 years.
Sure, he dominated. I mean, the guy was a force out there, and you know, and he had a good postseason in 2006. But again, 3 seasons, does that qualify you as a Hall of Famer? I don't know. I'm going to have to say no. I think Beltran had a bigger body of work, but how about the whole cheating thing? You know, I mean, do you want
I think you can't, like, for what Carlos Beltran did in a Mets uniform, I don't think, like, that has to, I think at this point, considering everybody involved has their job again, who had a much bigger power than Carlos Beltran did on that squad, that's where I think that you have to consider the nuance of Carlos Beltran being fired there. Not to say that he shouldn't have been fired in the you know, the current situation, and I'm not saying he needs his job back. I like the evaluation of Luis Rojas right now. However, I still think that doesn't take away. I don't think we should, like, Pete Rose, you know, what is it? Pete Rose is even in the Cincinnati Hall of Fame, I believe, the Reds Hall of Fame. They didn't deny him, even if he's denied of baseball. And I guess that was a loophole somehow. But that's why I would say that I still think is what Carlos Beltran did as a player. And considering if you know, at this point, like, you know, he wanted to rewrite history as the manager, there's really no other way to do that. So why don't we just make peace?
I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. I'm just wondering if anybody, if the Mets being, you know, conscious of reputation and all that, you know, just think about it, right? The guy was, you know, accused of and fired for being part of a cheating scam. He was fired as a manager before he ever managed a game for the same reason. And here I put him in the Team Hall of Fame. I have no problem with it personally. I want him in the Hall of Fame. The guy was a great Met, great with a capital G. But I just wonder, you know, how other people would view that. Like, I mean, what is the general reaction? I don't know. It's an interesting one. I mean, it sounds like you don't have a problem with it either.
I don't have a problem with it because, like I said, I think this is – you have to look at what he did as a Met, and there's nothing pointing to him cheating as a Met, as a player. So, you know, like – That basically, if he wants to rewrite history, I think, like, the fan base, the franchise, and the fact that, like, both A.J. Hinch and Alex Cora,
Cora.
How mm-hmm. could I space on him? He's 2009 shortstop. You know, I think that the fact that they have been welcomed back into the league with open arms just says what a farce the entire thing might be anyway.
Yeah, right. You're right. It was A.J. Hinch is employed. Cora is employed. Beltran, I imagine, could be if he wanted to be. Yeah, I mean, but getting back to the point, I think he should be in the Mets Hall of Fame. I think you're always going to have – there would probably be 10% of the fan base who would say, oh, so you fire the guy as a manager because he cheated, but then you put him in your Hall of Fame. Typical Mets. I mean, you're going to get some of that.
Yeah.
But I'm not
he
signing
deserves
my
it.
Name
he
to
deserves
that.
It. He's the best center fielder in Mets history.
Absolutely, no question. I mean, Tommy Agee was great, but again, very small body of work, and not the numbers don't compare to Beltran. So I know, Sam, we've hit the bottom of the hour.
I know we're getting close to there, but let me just throw this out there. Let's just remind everybody that he was an all-star in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of like the 6 or 7 year contract that he signed. Like, come on, man, come on.
Oh, yeah. No, believe me. Beltran is one of my favorite Mets of all time. He's in my top 10. So, and you've been listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and kind of a unique edition. We had beat writer from The Record, Justin Toscano, with us for the first 45 minutes. Got some great insights from him. Mike LeColin, one of our podcasting cohorts, had to leave the show about 8:40 to take care of some personal business. So Sam and I have been talking Mets baseball for the past 45 minutes. So, Sam, I think we've hit the point where we want to do our last word here, and I'm going to turn it to you and ask for your shameless plug. Where can people find you on Twitter? What are you up to these days? And also then your last word for the evening.
For sure. Thank you, Rich. And, again, thanks to The Record's Justin Toscano for joining us this evening. And you know, Mike LeColin, of course, we wish you were here right now, but thank you for joining earlier. So I would say my shameless plug is @_SamMaxwell. You can also find some of my blog writings, convertedheadsfan.blogspot.com. I haven't done really much updating lately, but there's plenty of good material there, and the specific one I would always point to is how I became a Mets fan. That dumping the Navy pinstripes for the orange and blue is the title of that piece that you can find right at the top on the right of the page. Bedford and Sullivan, the story of Brooklyn and its Dodgers that I'm trying to screenwrite. Max, an American documentary about my dad looking back on his life and acting career as he took on the biggest role yet fighting pancreatic cancer. So lots to come.
Awesome. Thank you, Sam. Always a pleasure talking baseball with you, my friend. And folks, that is a wrap for this edition of the Mets Team Podcast. We'd like to thank everyone who listened live, everyone who will download, as they say, wherever you download your podcast. So thanks to everyone who listens to us and all the support. We look forward to having many of these, at least one a week for the rest of the season. We heard from Justin that he believes the Mets will be playing after October 3rd. And, you know, as we say, from his lips to God's ears on that one. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Have yourself a great evening. And, Sam, I will defer to you to take us out the only way we know how.
Let's go, Mets. Let's take this. Let's take this shit, as Travis d'Arnaud once said. 6 years later, let's do it again. Except this time, let's take that ring. Let's go, Mets.
I'm with you, Sam, and I want to back up one thing you said. You said earlier you have to take advantage of it while you have it, and I agree 100%. You know, you don't know what the division is going to look like next year. The Mets are in it. Let's go for it. I don't want to think about 3 years from now because you don't know what's going to happen then. They're in first place now. Let's go for it. It starts with at least 3 out of 4 in Miami. Have a great night, everyone, and thank you, Sam.
Exactly. Exactly. Who says we can't beat the Giants? Who says we can't beat the Dodgers? Who says we can't beat the Padres? We can beat anybody. We're the New York Mets. Good night, all. Let's go, Mets.
Good night, everyone.